Welcome to podcast number 125 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is April 13th, 2021, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Our guest this week is Simon McCleave. Simon was born in South London. When leaving university, he worked in television and film development. He was a script editor at the BBC, a producer at Channel 4, before working as a story analyst in Los Angeles. He worked on such films as The Full Monty and television series such as the BBC crime drama Between the Lines. Simon then became a scriptwriter for television and film. He wrote on a series such as Silent Witness, Murder in Suburbia, Teachers, Attachments, The Bill, EastEnders, and many more. His film, Out of the Game for Channel 4, was critically acclaimed. Simon is now a best-selling crime novelist. He has over 300,000 sales and downloads of his Detective Inspector Ruth Hunter crime thriller series. The first book in that series, The Snowdonia Killings, has had over 100,000 readers and reached the top 10 of the Amazon chart. His five subsequent novels in the D.I. Ruth Hunter crime thriller series have all ranked in the Amazon top 20 and are all Amazon bestsellers. And he's just now signed a deal to turn the books into a television series. This is a fun interview, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. Welcome to My Favorite Detective Stories. My Favorite Detective Stories features crime fiction writers who discuss their latest books and what makes their fictional detectives tick. Throughout my investigative career spanning five decades, I cannot think of a time that I didn't have a good crime novel on my coffee table or bedstand. We will also talk about their favorite authors as well. On alternating weeks, we are introducing a new podcast, How to Rocket Your PI Business, featuring successful private investigators. They offer insights into their careers and advice for those just starting out or for those who are struggling. We will learn from the best. And of course, we cannot finish the show without asking them to share a few of their favorite detective stories and sage marketing tips. As a working investigator, coach, and writer, I hope to bring you inspiration, information, and entertainment in the areas that interest me most. Gather around my campfire as I invite you to listen in. This episode of My Favorite Detective Stories is brought to you by my own crime thriller with a mystery twist, Odessa on the Delaware, introducing Marcia O'Shea, my debut novel. A Russian gang enforcer is on a murderous rampage to take over the entire Philadelphia mob scene. A homeless vet doesn't know that he has the proof or that he's next on the list. The stakes are high for this deadly cat-and-mouse game set on the bleak Philly waterfront of years gone by. FBI agent Marcia O'Shea, a gunslinger from the Miami drug cartel days, is back in her hometown, quietly finishing out her career, but is now drawn into this case with a secret pushing her doggedly to follow the clues, only to uncover a greater secret that may get her killed in the final showdown. I'm excited to talk about Odessa on the Delaware, and for my readers and listeners, it is now free at my website, www.johnhoda.com. I'm glad to offer this book to you as a way of introducing you to FBI agent Marcia O'Shea, because the series with her continues with Clearwater Blues, Detroit Wheels, and West Reading Traffic. Hi, Simon. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. It's great to be here.
So how's life out in North Wales?
Yeah.
In the UK?
We're in the UK. It's about minus five out, which is pretty cold for North Wales. It's a bit of a dusting of snow, icy, and we're in lockdown. So we're stuck indoors, taking the dog for a walk and trying to keep warm, but that's about it. But it's okay.
Well, here in southwestern Connecticut, as we record this today, February 11th, Thursday, every other day it's been snowing here in Connecticut, and kind of unusual. We have more like New York City weather. And so I've been getting a lot of exercise with my shovel and skating behind my dog as my dog drags me along doing his sniffing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm so happy that you came on the show today. I heard you on the self-publishing show several months ago, and we share an editor by the name of Rebecca Millar.
Yeah.
And I reached out to you, and you were very gracious to want to come in on the podcast. And I just want to thank you so much for that. So as I ask all my guests, tell me about your career and tell me how you got started with your writing, and I'll sit back and, like a good listener, listen.
I've been writing for many, many years now, I suppose. I wrote a play at university, so that was back in 1990, so that's a long time ago, and took that to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. I then spent some time working as a script editor. So I worked with writers on their scripts, editing those for TV and for film for a while. I worked at the BBC in their drama department, working on their programs, devising programs and coming up with scripts. And so for a while, for a good sort of 6-7 years, I worked with writers, making their scripts better, making their ideas better, or hopefully anyway.
For the new medium of either TV or movie.
Yeah. So, yes. You know, and I suppose that gave me, when I sort of think about what I'm doing now, that gave me a very good kind of grounding in structure, character, dialogue, continually kind of being exposed to that. And then after a while, I sort of went from gamekeeper to poacher. And I decided that I would give it a go to being an actual writer of scripts. So then I spent another 5 or 6 years mainly writing TV stuff like cop shows like The Bill, soaps like EastEnders, Midsummer Murders, Silent Witness. So if you're in the UK, these are kind of sort of mainstream, mainly sort of TV cop shows, and wrote a lot of those. And I suppose learnt a lot again because they're long-running series. You write fast and you write quickly and you then also rewrite fast. So you write a script and then your editor will ask you, will give you 24 hours to turn it around and implement the notes and do another draft. So again, in terms of what I do now, it was a good learning experience. And I guess after a while that I think the only problem with being a writer in the UK television is that you are very close to the bottom of the pile in terms of any power, any kind of creativity, and they hire and fire you without a moment's notice. It's quite brutal, you know, and your script editor and the producer will cut lines from your script and they will add lines of their own to your script. And there were times that I was going out and I knew that a scene had been written by in a certain way by me, and it went out and I went, I don't know what they've done to that scene, but I think it's 100 times worse. And it got, there were certain points when I just stopped. I mean, obviously the first few times you sit and, you know, this is kind of end of the 90s maybe, or just at the millennium. There are certain times okay. when you sort of sit down and obviously you see your name come up at the beginning of a TV program and your name is up there as the writer, and there isn't real
balance. Sure.
However, it got to the point after a few years where I just stopped watching stuff going out. And my wife went, I'm not sure that this is healthy for you. And so we relocated from South London to North Wales. And I retrained to be a teacher. And I did that for a few years just to sort of, I think the intention was to do something else. But I fancied teaching English and media, which I kind of was pretty much trained to do anyway. And sort of dusted myself down, I guess, and kind of took it easy for a while. And then various people kept saying, why are you not writing? Why are you not, you know, why are you not doing something? You love writing. You did it for a long time. And I just had an idea for one book. I had an idea for a detective and I had an idea for a plot. And we live in an area of North Wales called Snowdonia. Well, we live on the edges of it, which is an incredibly beautiful, desolate kind of mountains, lakes, beaches, very sparsely populated, but stunning. As far as I knew, there'd be no books or TV series written about the area, but it seemed to make perfect sense to set a series around a series of books around there. So I started maybe three or four years ago, just starting to have a little go at writing a novel. You know, I could have written a screenplay, but I knew that actually the chances of getting a screenplay or a TV series away were very, very slim. And I knew that if I wrote a novel, at least I could kind of give it to other people to read and that product would be there in someone's hand. And I thought maybe it was a different way to go.
Now you're an independent author, as I am.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things about that, but we won't get into all the niggly stuff, but we will talk about the freedom and creativity that allows you to do. So. And I think that this was what you were looking for, to have more freedom and more say in what your final product would be.
Yeah, I mean, that's the creative freedom of being an indie author is incredible. It's incredibly powerful because you write how you want to write. I mean, I take advice and I have an editor. Rebecca's a very good editor. And I have someone else that looks at my books towards the end of the process as well and gives me lots of ideas. But I don't have a publishing house that will tell me you can't write that, or we don't like what you've done. And the idea that I can write a book and a story with the characters that I want and take it where I want is a fantastic in terms of that kind of freedom. Having come from, you know, the restrictions of TV writing, which is where you pretty much have no say in what you're going to write. So it's great, yeah, as I know you know.
I do, and complete control over who you choose for your editors, your copy editors, your proofreaders, your cover designers, how you choose to format it, everything. And, you know, the other flip side of that is, oh, that's a lot of work. Well, yes and no. Once you find the right people to work with, it becomes a team effort, and you can trust them to give their best effort to help you. So,
yeah, that kind of speed of turnaround as well. You know, I have friends who've got publishing deals, and, you know, the best estimate was that the first novel, if they picked it up, would take 18 months to find its way onto Amazon or into a shop. Whereas going the indie route, I could do that in a couple of months.
Okay.
And so, yeah.
So I'm very happy to hear that you decided to go out on your own. And this idea that it was going to take place in Snowdonia was the novel that immediately after the podcast with you on it, mentioning our editor in common, that I went out and read it, and I it was the Snowdonia killings.
Yeah, yes. That's right. The Snowdonia
killings. So very interesting, and a little bit like you, protagonist is from South London and moves up to what had been a bucolic childhood memory for her, and she doesn't even get her bags down, and she's into a into a homicide. Side. So,
yes.
If you want to talk about your protagonist, Ruth Hunter, a little bit for us, I'd love to hear how she ticks and what her foibles and strengths are. And, you know,
yeah, I think, you know, it was I think the idea was that, you know, having been in South London for 35, 37 years and then moving to up here, there was a kind of, you know, the change of pace of life, the culture is very different. And it seemed like a good idea to have a character experiencing Snowdonia, North Wales, coming from the, you know, a city of whatever it is, you know, 8 to 9 million, and the kind of the culture of South London, the gangs, drugs, you know, it's a pretty rough place to be. So it just seemed perfect in a way of her arriving and her preconceptions of what it would be like, and having those preconceptions, you know, changed. Preconceptions of the people she's about to work with, of a, you know, female London detective inspector who they think probably thinks that she knows everything and is going to be patronizing. So it just seemed to me it's like a recipe there for you know, conflict and growth and interesting characters. She also has, I have an ongoing story, backstory for her, in that she had a partner that they lived together, and her partner got on a train in London one morning and vanished off the face of the earth. This is 4 years prior to the Snowdonia killings starting. And no one ever heard from her again. This Sarah, her name was. And there's a kind of quest that goes throughout the series of Ruth wondering what happened to her partner, of finding small clues as the books go on to where she is, whether she's still alive. But it's quite, it's sort of, in some ways for Ruth, it's an escape to get to of the ghost of Sarah to move up to Snowdonia, or at least that's what she perceives it to be. She goes, well, you know, I'm starting a new life to get away from that ghost that haunts her. But of course she takes it with her as she finds out when she settles.
Thinking that she saw Sarah outside of a pub, I think, one day.
That's right. And she chases her down the back streets. And
right. And then there was a very text message towards the very, very end of Snowdonia, and it was supposed to be from Sarah.
That's so, right, yeah.
Yeah, I like the way you drip this out. I appreciate when we have a story that is always in the background of our character and their motivations and what drives them. And I think in this case, you know, the missing Sarah serves that purpose very, very well, and it comes across very cleanly and Snowdonia. So
for me, it meant that Ruth getting into any decent relationship with anyone else, incredibly difficult for both her and for anyone new, because she had someone that she was madly in love with who disappeared. She has no idea whether this person's alive or dead. She doesn't know what's happened to them. So she's kind of stuck, but she would like to move on with her life. Can she do that? And, you know, and another person coming in thinking, well, do I want to live with someone who's still living in the past, hankering after someone that she still doesn't know what's happened to them? And it makes that incredibly rich in terms of the dynamics of any relationships that she has in the present.
Mm-hmm. So you wrote Snowdonia and you decided mm-hmm. to write the next one and the next one yeah. and the next yeah. one and the next one. Yeah. So yeah. how did I yeah. just kind of like walk me through that? Because did you look for validation from Snowdonia first before writing the other ones, or did you write the other yeah. ones? Okay. I'm sorry.
I got to the end of it, and because I'd enjoyed it so much, I thought, when I first started typing up, mm-hmm. I thought this might be a one-off novel. I don't know what's going to happen to it, and it's just for my own pleasure. I really didn't think that anything would happen to it. I really thought
okay.
it was just an exercise, a creative exercise while I was teaching. And actually, I'm going to, yeah, it's my mother. My mother is my target audience. She's in her 70s. She's sort of retired, and mm-hmm. she hoovers up crime novel series, UK-based. She just hoovers them up and she reads them, you know, reads one a day almost. Now, I know she's biased, but she read it and said, well, obviously she thought it was good, but I didn't really take that as a, she's my mum. But she said, actually, honestly, if I'm looking at this with any kind of degree of sort of reality, this doesn't read any different to the books that I read day in, day out. And I showed, you know, and then I showed a couple of friends and they went, yeah, you know what? This is a good story. The character's there. It needs a bit of work. So, you know, it was okay. I didn't think it was going to be, you know, it was going to win me any prizes, but it worked. And I did actually, I sent it off to a few literary agents and I still had contacts from the TV time. So I got a couple of people to read it who said, there's some stuff in here that's really good, but I had a lot of learning to do. And, I learned a hell of a lot on the first two books about how to write a decent novel. And I suppose once I got the bug and actually thought, this is a really good, I'm really enjoying this. I would like to spend every day doing this rather than lunch breaks and after school. Mm-hmm. That kind of spurred me on to think, can I make this my career? And I suppose I grabbed
think you
that
did.
With both hands.
At some point, how far down the Ruth Hunter books did you go before you decided to write the prequel?
Wrote the first two. In fact, actually, I think I always thought I don't want to write a prequel. The perceived wisdom in the indie world was to have a prequel or some kind of novella for my mailing list. And I always thought, well, I don't really want to spend time doing that. But actually, I then thought of an idea. Mm-hmm. Once I kind of got around the idea that I had to write something, I suppose the more I explored Ruth and her past, I thought actually it would be really interesting to go back and see her when she first joins the Met Police in the early 90s. What was that like? What kind of character was she? And it just seemed actually as a creative exercise, it was incredibly useful for me to go back and do that. Really, I think I wrote it in 3 or 4 weeks, but it was sort of, I just really enjoyed going back and actually doing it once I decided that I was going to do it.
And yeah. It worked. The theater street killing.
Yeah.
It was a nice
that's right, yeah.
way of setting up older Ruth. And but then you also decided to write as Ruth as a detective in South London in the late 90s. So how did that come about? What was your thinking on that?
I mean, I'd enjoyed writing the prequel so much that I thought there was probably more material to be mined out of her working in London. I also quite liked that there was part of me that was fascinated that even I've got a friend who's a female detective down in Dorset, which is in the south of England. And speaking to her, that the 90s there was still that kind of idea that, you know, female officers were not to be trusted. Female officers were given lesser crimes to investigate. Female officers were given certain types of crimes to investigate. Certainly in uniform, there was still kind of the overhang of, you know, go and get me a cup of tea because you're a female officer. Very old-fashioned views. I think the Met Police in London took a long time to kind of turn around that male culture that existed within both CID and uniform. And that makes it really interesting seeing her then and then seeing her 30 years later now as she's kind of running a whole CID team and no one really sort of bats an eyelid. It's just how kind of that modern policing has progressed so much. But also, it was also from readers. There were I had many, many emails from readers who said, are you ever going to write about Ruth when she was in London before she came to Wales? And I suppose the more emails I got from readers, I thought, well, there's also a market for people that would like to read about it. And I'm the same age as Ruth, and I remember the late 90s very well. It was a really interesting time in London. There's a whole kind of Britpop. There was the death of Diana. There was a new Labour government. It was quite an exciting time to be in London, the late 90s. There was a lot going on. So I kind of felt as a backdrop, there was also stuff that I could explore there in terms of a sort of cultural backdrop to the series. So yeah, it seems at the moment I've got a few ideas. So we're going to keep running with that as well.
Which is really unique, I have to tell you. So you write older Ruth, you know, and then you do the for two books, and then you write the prequel. You get great feedback from the prequel that they want to hear more of younger Ruth. You're interested in writing about the younger Ruth. So now you're writing, well, what would be the equivalent of two series now, younger Ruth in London and older Ruth, wiser Ruth in North Wales, which is, you know, totally different world. And, but yet you have to be mindful of her character arc from that girl that liked the raves and smoking ciggies, you know, and then, the boyfriend then becomes the husband, and the husband then becomes the ex-husband. But keeping all that in track, I can just imagine it's like playing three levels of chess.
Yes. And I'm terrible, actually, because I don't know about you, but I don't have it always written down where I can put my hand to it. I know there are writers that are very diligent about writing a Bible and have all the stuff down and, you know, who's her brother and when were they born and which school do they go to? And I've just been incredibly lazy. And normally I rely on Rebecca to say, actually, I think his name's Alan or something. And I go, and I know that I should really have done this, but I kind of wing it. Or I sort of know roughly whereabouts it might be.
Yeah. And for me, with my protagonist, I have a notebook that I did a character Bible on her originally.
Yeah.
And I know where it's at. So that I go back to it to make sure that I don't say, you know, that her hair is always chestnut blonde and not some other color. And, but then as I add new factoids about her, I go back to the book, to the composition notebook, and I write in those little factoids. So I add to the Bible. I mean, you know, it's like the New Testament, you know,
to
add newer portions of it. I get what you're saying. So this is just incredibly much, a lot of fun. And, I now in the wiser Ruth also has a partner, Nick Jones, and he has his issues. And I looked at the prequel that you wanted for him, and I didn't know if there was also interest in Nick. Were your readers saying, "Hey, we want to know more about Nick and Nick's journey too," or what was your thinking about doing the prequel for him?
To do with Nick, I thought he is an interesting character. He's got a very dark, you know, dark kind of conflicts within him. He had a fairly traumatic childhood, and he's got a lot of demons that he still needs to kind of exercise. But also I created a gangster character called Curtis Blake, who is a Liverpudlian sort of drug dealer. And they have a kind of ongoing sort of feud in some of the books he crops up. And I wanted to kind of work out where that feud had started. So that's the story. The story is really about two guys almost the same age. One comes from Liverpool, one comes from North Wales. They sort of start on a level. One becomes a copper and one becomes a criminal. And there are certain things that happen that draw them together in a story. If I think instinctively I get excited about writing it, then hopefully other people will. So it was just something I wanted to explore, I want to come back to that gangster character at some point, because I think he's fascinating. And I did a lot of reading about the guys in Liverpool that kind of run the drugs around the country and ship drugs in from Holland and all that kind of stuff. I just thought there was a kind of real interesting world there that hadn't been explored before. So that was a tentative step in that sort of direction.
Well, that begs the question, on those alternate days when you're not writing wiser Ruth or younger Ruth, are you thinking about going into a stand or a series with Nick? Or are you going to say, I'll never say never?
I'll never say never, but actually, if I was going to do anything, I would be taking the gangster character called Curtis Blake, and I would be looking at him in a sort of Sopranos-esque family, crime family kind of saga of books set in Liverpool, and looking at that kind of underworld that way, rather than having a Nick spin-off, I would kind of use it in that way, I think.
I like that idea. So I'm giving you feedback through in the middle of a podcast.
Yeah,
but I like that idea a lot. And I think that there's nothing wrong with Nick Jones, don't get me wrong. And as a sidekick, and he stays a sidekick through, you're coming up on your eighth book of D.I. Ruth Hunter, the Minai, Bridge Killings, which is coming out a couple, 3 weeks, February 28th.
Minai, Bridge Killings, yeah.
You'll tell us at the end how people can get them. But the idea of working on Curtis Blake, you know, flexes some different muscles for you, but a different character to play with other than, you know, Ruth staring over the last dead body. And I don't mean to make that sound like, oh my God, here it goes again. But you don't understand what I'm saying. It gives it a much different.
Yeah. And those books, you know, we know, I've read enough books and watched enough TV shows and films to know that, you know, a police investigation story has certain tropes and a certain structure that everybody expects. And you have to follow those. You can break some of them, but people want to get the twist at the end of the dead body at the beginning and how it worked out, who did it and all that kind of stuff.
And, so, and I'm not taking away from Ruth at all, either, you know, the young Ruth or the wiser Ruth, because I love those kind of books myself. I'm the Hoover of those books, to quote you from earlier.
Yeah.
So I'll always be, looking at the clock at 2 o'clock in the morning and saying, darn it, that was a great book, but I have to get up in the morning.
Exactly.
And as long as those books continue to do that for me, then I'm going to continue to read them. So, well, you didn't come to 8 books on D.I. Ruth Hunter, or you didn't come into writing the next installment of Young Ruth in South London without having some, you know, feedback and seeing that, you know, this idea of yours was working. And there are things that you had to do to help make it work as an indie author. And we won't get into that today because that's a lot of the mechanics and tactics of being a publisher of your own work. But let's just say, at what point did you say, hey, this is working?
there were some moments where, I sold my first book just over a year ago.
Wow.
So, so it was my anniversary. I think on the 2nd of February was my first ever sale. The Snowdonia Killings was free during January 2020. First time I ever sold a book for money.
Makes sense.
February the 2nd. So it's been a complete, you know, it's been a roller coaster. Someone told me it'll be an amazing ride, and so far it has been. But I'm guessing 2 or 3 months into I released the first 3 books in the first 3 months. So I did, you know, I was kind of rapid release. And after the third book released, I was looking at the sales and the number of copies I was selling a day and went, this is quite a lot more than I was expecting. and I don't know why. And the pre-orders were good and the reviews were good. And I suppose I just started to go, well, whatever I'm doing, people seem to want to buy it. And I've got plenty more ideas to kind of churn out some more books. So I'm guessing sort of 3 or 4 months into that, I realized that I could probably not go back to teaching. Which was, although I loved it, it was also a huge relief as well. I'm very, very lucky to have a job where I can sit at home and kind of on a computer and sit and write books. It's a great way to live, and I'm sort of very grateful for that.
And take the dog out for walks.
Take the dog out for walks, and you know, it's a lot easier than trying to persuade, you know, 30, 16-year-olds to do Macbeth. So,
oh God, no,
That was that's a tough call.
Yeah, no, that one. I enjoy that though. So I'm saying that, but and of course it goes back to also, publishing right and marketing right, and it allowed you once you put those things into place. And I would just we'll just kind of lump it into very good best practices. I see that you do some things. You do it often. You do it well. You do it consistently. You execute very nicely. And other than saying that, though, I mean, it frees you up to actually pursue younger Ruth Hunter, you know, with the Britpop in the late '90s. It allows you to a deep dive into Curtis Blake and what makes this criminal mind tick. You know, the Moriarty of the late '90s. So, absolutely. But it gives you that opportunity to do so, and I think this is fantastic.
I mean, for me, it's all about the characters. I think the stories are kind of the stories of the stories, and they work in a sort of generic way. But I think for whatever reason, the readers seem to connect with Ruth because she's very fallible. She has lots of, she's a bit dishonest. She drinks too much. She smokes too much. She kind of does stuff that actually you kind of think, what are you doing? And I think people like that because she's not, there's no perfection in her life. And she does stuff that's kind of often irrational. And yet she's very, very kind of organized and professionally, she's very good at her job.
And driven.
And driven. And she likes, you know, and she's very kind of caring and compassionate as a police officer. And then you kind of get insights into her personal life, and it's complete chaos. And I suppose people, for whatever reason, people like to read that, and therefore they want to stick with her, which is good for me.
No, I see that as well. You know, in my short time with you in the Theater Street Killing and Snowdonia, and the first one of the young Ruth, which was Diary of a War Crime. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
I have it right here. I wrote it down. I have my notes.
Good.
But yes, so I wanted to sample all three, and I did. And I'm going to continue with Ruth, both young Ruth.
And
the next installment of young Ruth, we don't have a tentative name yet, but you're thinking possibly in April?
Yeah. Okay. It's definitely around. And it's all about, it's about the gangs of the 50s, actually. It's a historic crime. So I've been doing a lot of interesting research about that.
Yeah, you gave us a little hint to that.
Teddy Boy gangs. Do you know what Teddy Boys are, right, in America?
I saw some early pictures of the Beatles in Hamburg, and I got a sense of the haircuts from them.
Yeah, they're sort of mid-50s into kind of Eddie Cochran and Elvis, kind of big quiffs and stuff. But they also, I mean, they were very, very violent. They went around with bicycle chains and knives and stuff and fought each other. And the research I did was incredible in South London was that each postcode, each area had their own Teddy Boy gang. And they would just go to various, they would all go out and they would go down to Balham or Clapham and fight each other, which is very sort of similar to what's going on 70 years later. So it was just interesting.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting kind of backdrop, and I'm quite, so yeah, I'm getting a lot of stuff out of that.
Fantastic. I'm going to look forward to that when it comes out. And of course, I'm on your mailing list, so I know.
Yeah.
And to that point, part of your recommended reading was that you just finished a J.M. DeGleish book, Bury Your Past. Can you talk about Jason and the book a little bit and why you thought it was so good?
Yeah, Jason Dalgleish is a very talented crime writer. He has one series set in Yorkshire called the Dark Yorkshire series, which is very good and kind of sort of Nordic noir. And then his second series, completely new characters, are set in Norfolk on the Broads. It's called Hidden Norfolk, and they're just very well structured, well crafted police procedurals. I can highly recommend them. I think he's probably on about book 7 or 8 of the Norfolk series. They're big sellers. And then Sally Rigby, she writes books set up north in England. And again, I've read quite a few of her books. And again, very talented writer. Everything's, you know, good structure, good characters. And so if you guys like that kind of police procedural stuff, UK based, then those are two authors to definitely look out for.
Oh, we love UK based. I mean, it's not necessarily more genteel; it's more civil. And I just, you know, and of course, you know, the attention to detail is, I certainly appreciate. Sally Rigby has and Latest Graves was the book that you mentioned. Cavendish and Walker book. 9. Now, Cavendish and Walker are who? I'm going to put you to the test.
Are the main characters in the book. So,
yeah. Okay. Are they law enforcement or police?
Yeah, they're police, yeah.
So definitely my favorite detective stories would love Jason DeGleish and Sally Rigby.
Definitely worth checking out.
And And I get my reading from the people that come on the podcast. They give me lots of advice. I also get to read their stuff, which I love doing. I'm going to continue reading Ruth, as I mentioned to you.
Yeah.
Didn't want to sound like a fanboy, but I enjoy it, you know, and I do. And I'll tell you what, you know, and you're finding out that each book you write a little bit better. So, and each time you put pen to paper, or, you know, you get your fanny in the chair and hands on the keyboard, that
that's right.
Something better is going to come out, because, you know, you feel like it's not that you owe it to your readers, but you want to keep moving in that direction. You want to keep getting better, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You just learn a little bit about the craft of writing each time, and the sort of notes that come back, and you think, I'll try that next time. So, I think that, you know, my writing now is a long way from the first book in terms of quality, I think.
I'll let your readers chime in on that. But so for me, I look at it this way. I say that, you know, for both of us, we've come to this a little bit later in life, me a little bit more later than you. But if we take seriously our craft, whether it was what we did before or what we do now, and we want to get better at it, and it keeps us young, keeps us moving, it keeps us vibrant, it keeps us thinking, it keeps us wanting to, you know, do better and better. I just like the idea that, you know, the vehicle that you have here between Ruth Hunter and the earlier version of Ruth, and then with the ideas that you're kicking around with Curtis Blake, are something that I think your readers are going to enjoy a great deal, and continue to support you for that. So we're a little shorter than normal today. We're running about almost 40 minutes at this point. But yes, Simon, I want to ask, how can people get in touch with you? How can people find your writing? And more importantly, how can they sign up to your wonderful newsletter? Because that is great. I enjoy it. And let me tell you, I read a lot of newsletters.
Right. Oh, that's good to know. Yeah. If you go to simonmcleave.com, McLeave is McLeave, you can sign up for my VIP email club. You'll get the first novella free straight away, which is The Theatre Street Killing. And then probably 10 days later, you'll get another free novella about Nick and Curtis Blake. So that's the best way to sign up and get going on my newsletters. That would be good. I've done competitions on there and stuff like that. So,
and if people want to purchase your books, where can they get them? Away from, of course, the links to your website, but where else could they go if they wanted, you know, buy them direct?
I have a deal with Amazon, so my books are on Amazon. If you go to Amazon.com or .co.uk, then you type in my name, then those books for the 7 books in the current Ruth Hunter series, plus the Menai Bridge, is up for pre-order. So that will come out on the 28th. But if you fancy you pre-ordering it now, you can do. And the Diary of a War Crime is on there as well, if you fancy having a read of that as a sort of retrospectively.
Well, thank you for your persistence in staying with me. I know that last week we had some tech problems. Gremlins descended on North Wales and Connecticut at the same time.
As they often do,
so. And but you stayed with me. And now and you also have some new gear, so that you...
I do have some fantastic new headphones, which I'm very happy about.
Be a professional podcast guest.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, John. I really, really have enjoyed talking to you and talking about Ruth with you. So it's been a really nice way to spend nearly an hour.
All right. Yes, sir. Thank you again, Simon.
Thanks, John.
Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. Our guest next week is Bill Clutter. Bill is a licensed private investigator who began his career in 1985 working as a law office investigator for Springfield criminal defense attorney Michael Mettner. During that time, he was part of the defense team that helped free Rolando Cruz and Alejandro Hernandez in the famous Nacarico case, which led to the arrest of police and prosecutors in a case that became known as the DuPage Seven. After the case ended, he began the post-conviction investigation that led to the exoneration of death row inmate Randy Steedle, who upon his release in 2004 began advocating the abolition of the death penalty in New Mexico, Illinois, and Connecticut as a spokesman for Witness to Innocence. In 2001, Bill founded the Illinois Innocence Project. In 2013, Bill formed a new national organization called Investigating Innocence after joining the CAM defense team. The core of this organization is made up of private investigators committed to working to free the innocent. There are nearly 70 innocence projects throughout the United States that hire private investigators.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear other great detective stories, please go to the website and click on our podcast page. There you'll find the backlist. Now, you're probably asking, John, what about your own stories? Do you have any? Sure enough, I do. And they are available to you free as a download right to your inbox. I have 8 short stories and 8 vignettes in a book titled Mugshots, My Favorite Detective Stories. Now, here's my ask. You were either informed, inspired, or entertained by the stories today. Don't be bashful. Share this link with your friends. Better still, go to the iTunes website and leave a review. It's the best way to grow the circle around our campfire. If you have any questions, please contact me through the website, www.johnhoda.com, J-O-H-N-H-O-D-A.com. Thanks so much, and have a great day.